You are listening to the Dharma Ocean podcast. As a religious historian, Reggie has closely studied the early Pali texts to better understand the human journey of the Buddha in ancient India. Today, we'll listen to excerpts from three different talks Reggie has given on the life and legacy of the historical Buddha.
The Buddha, you know, like all of us, grew up in a culture, and initially as a child he introjected, you know, to use a psychological term, the view of his parents and the view of his culture. And one of the sort of the thing about human beings is that they create mental worlds and they live in them. And then there's a kind of process of, if the mental world is sufficiently porous, then you can maintain contact with reality. If it becomes too solid, then you go insane. So we're all sort of living somewhere between sanity and insanity, always. And he, you know, he made this journey of beginning to discover that everything that he thought wasn't right. And in fact, even the mere fact of thinking isn't right. And he had to let go of everything in his life. He had to let go of his family. He had to let go of his culture. He had to let go of all the things that he believed about what is true. And he even had to let go of all the spiritual traditions that were available, and he studied them, and he met some very powerful people. But in the end, he realized that they also had their ideas. And his discovery, which was that he lost everything, when he sat beneath the tree of enlightenment, and he realized that truly there is nothing except just the absolute nakedness of mind, where there are no thoughts, and there is no territory, there is no ground, there's no retreat, and in fact there's no time. Even time is our thing that we make up. And no one had come across this, or if they had, they hadn't told anybody in a long time. And he did say, you know, this used to be known. This way of living used to be known, but everybody has become so enamored of all the different ways in which you can think about reality and image it and control it and feel like you have some reference point, that it's been lost, and I found it, and I'm awake. Many people in his day were very angry at him and felt that he was disloyal. And they had all their different versions of his disloyalty. Disloyal to his family, disloyal to his culture. Many people were outraged that he didn't go along with the caste system and that he treated people who were at the bottom of the social scale with the same amount of respect he treated people who were at the top. Disloyal to these former teachers that he'd studied with, disloyal to the spiritual values of India. People were very angry because what he said is there's no freedom anywhere from top to bottom. The only freedom is when you actually step out of it altogether, when you allow yourself to be stripped down to nothing. Part of the thing that outraged people about the Buddha was that the Dharma is not for sale at any price. And he lived in a world where everybody use the Dharma as bait. The Dharma here meaning the teaching. It's bait. It's bait to attract people. It's bait to get large donations. It's bait to establish your reputation. It's bait to collect people together into social situations. And he didn't go along with it. He was willing to live in a way that truly, you know, his own life actually was threatened by other people. This is not well known about the Buddha. We have this very pleasant account of his life. If you read between the lines, no. But very pleasant person. Everybody loved him. The kings loved him. He went to the cities. Everybody came out to hear him. Oh, no. Thich Nhat Hanh put together a lot of texts and did a lot of research, actually, in the Chinese canon. where there are a lot of things preserved that we don't have preserved in some of the other canons. And he wrote this book called The All Path White Clouds, which is a life of the Buddha, which seems in a way very contemporary. But then you look at the man's sources, and actually he's drawing in a lot of things. People hated the Buddha. A lot of people hated him. A lot of people wanted him dead. And there were many attempts basically to frame him and accuse him and his disciples of doing all kinds of terrible things. And you wonder, well, what's the problem? I mean, the man was so gentle, and the man had so much integrity. Well, that is exactly the problem. People didn't want to hear about it. You know, he was a very outrageous teacher in that way. So this tradition stayed alive for a long time, down to the present. And it's become a very, you know, it's become part of human cultures throughout the world. And it has many different forms, many different levels, and it's reflected, you know, all the way from yogis meditating in caves to pretty much an amalgamation between the institutionalized Buddhism and the political powers in different countries. So you see a whole complete range. And there is a kind of living spring. And sometimes that living spring gets covered over. In fact, often it does in Buddhist tradition. But the living spring that, in a way, is the life of this tradition has never died out. And in the early Prajnaparamita, you know, this was a secret teaching. It was a teaching in the jungles. These people, very much in that line. And then, of course, the Siddhas in India, somewhere, you know, after the 3rd or 4th century, they held this tradition. And they were also people who really didn't have anything to do with the establishment at all. And there have always been a few people who have kept it, have stayed in touch with it. And there have been many times in Buddhist history when it seemed that it had died out. And then some people, men and women, wandering around in the jungle somewhere found it. And they stayed there and they nourished themselves. And then they came and brought it back to us. If you look at the life of the Buddha and you look at what he discovered, there's no question whatsoever that it's exactly this that he found. It does seem that we have to reconfigure our understanding on so many things when we do this kind of work. Because whether we know it or not, or whether we like it or not, there's a kind of a default understanding in our culture that's everywhere. And one of the insights of the Dharma is that we have to dismantle the existing understanding that we have. And we have to come at things in a different way. Our relationship to the Buddha himself is, it's not that we venerate him or we put him up on a, you know, on a high altar and bow down to him, but that we're called to emulate him. You know, each one of us is called to make the exact same journey that he did. And I think the lie of organized religion and, you know, frankly, with all due respect, the lie of Buddhist tradition in general is that somehow the Buddha is different from us and that we can't really measure up to what he did, and therefore we have to sort of just venerate him and venerate the traditions that claim to represent him and follow their rules and do things their way. But that's not what the Buddha did. And also, if you look at the early tradition, that's not what he offered. That's not what he was teaching. There are these wonderful songs known as the Theragata and the Therigata. Thera means elder, male. Gata means song. Theri means elder, female. Gata means song. So these are the songs of the men and women of the earliest tradition. And these are very interesting because they predate the Theravadin tradition. Theravada is usually thought of as the earliest tradition, but these actually predate them, and in the Theravadin canon,
You know, there are five so-called collections of texts in the Theravada canon, and one of them, the Kutaka Nikaya, was a dumping ground for all the texts that they considered, they couldn't throw them away because they were so old, but they were no longer relevant. And these songs of these elder men and women who lived at the time of the Buddha were dumped into this category of no longer relevant. But if you read them, you know, they're in translation, if you read them, what you find out is that these people were doing exactly the same thing that the Buddha did, and they were called to exactly the same journey that he made. And what is that journey? That journey is whatever your circumstances and whatever has been laid on you as the way in which you're supposed to live your life, personally and socially and religiously, it has to go. It has to be let go of. And each person, just the way the Buddha did, I mean, he basically arrived at ground zero. And he had the weight of, even by his day, Indian culture was 3,000 years old. So he had the weight, this huge weight of culture behind him, of history and culture. And he had to basically pick his way through it, and he realized that this wasn't the answer, and that wasn't the answer. And even in terms of mental states, there were a lot of mental states that were set up as, if you achieve this mental state, you're going to be free and you're going to be happy. And he went so far as to actually follow the traditions and arrive at the mental state that was being offered, and he realized, no, that's not it, it's a lie. So, you know, he had to dismantle the lie of organized religion and organized culture and conventional values. And he arrived at ground zero, which means at a certain point he had nothing to say for himself. He had no excuses and no defenses. He had no agendas. He had no past and no future. And when he arrived at that point of having let go of everything that he was hanging on to, then he found out really what it means to be human. He arrived at a place that was completely open, and in that space was reflected the very totality that he'd been looking for all his life. But the only way to do it was to become totally alone and let go of all the safety and all the reference points, and that's what he did. He made that journey. And in these songs of these early people, men and women, they were called to the same journey, and they're very intimate, and you find the Buddha working with them as a friend, you know, not as some kind of high and mighty teacher, but as a friend. And they actually called him friend. My friend, you know, told me this, and my friend told me that. And there was a tremendous love is reflected in these songs. You know, they loved him and he loved them. Very, very strong sense of mutual devotion. But he was calling them to make the same exact journey that he made, and so are we. You know, we're called to that very journey. And that's, you know, in Buddhist tradition, that has always been a very peripheral value. 99.9% of all Buddhists do it the other way, the organized religion way in the world, which is, if you've traveled, it's very shocking. You expect something different, and what you get is not different. But there was this 0.1% throughout Buddhist history of people who really understood their job was to do what he did. And now we're in a phase in life where the other thing really doesn't work, and a lot more of us are called to it than has ever been true. So, this is us. We have to make the journey, and it is a totally solitary journey. And, you know, at the end of the day, there's no community, there's no bunch of texts, there's no organization, there's no teacher, and there's not even any teaching that's going to save us. However, all of those things can become part of the journey of our dismantling of our own neurotic, clinging to something less than what we really are. You know, they can all be part of it. So that's what we're, you know, that's what we're doing. That's what we're exploring. The way we could frame it is to say that the Buddha's legacy is not organized religion. That's not the Buddha's legacy. But we as people who are not, you know, we've been through the organized religion thing up, down, and sideways. And, you know, for most of us, you know, and particularly with the benefit of Western thinkers like Marx and Freud and, you know, sociologists like Max Weber and, you know, we have there's a lot of sophistication around our realizing the limits of organized religion. But in any case, I think we're in a place now and we see the Buddha's legacy is not organized religion. Interesting. So what we see in our world today is two alternatives, you know, that are up. And all of us are trying to deal with this even in our own psyche and even within our own community. You know, we're dealing with these issues. On the one hand, there is the organized religion approach, which those of us who were brought up within the Judeo-Christian tradition were looking for something else, and we thought, at least I thought, you know, a lot of people I know thought that Asian organized religion was different from Western organized religion, and that somehow Asian organized religion was better, and it had fewer of the foibles and liabilities of Western organized religion. But of course, the more we go into it, and in my case, the more I studied it, the more I realized that, you know, organized religion is, the problem with organized religion is it's organized. And it's, you know, and this is something that somebody like Max Weber, who's a founder of, you know, modern sociology of religion, really made very clear, that once you begin to organize, you have to organize according to principles and rules and regulations. You were talking about institutional organization. And, you know, you have to have, you know, gates, and you have to have criteria for entry into a religion, and you have to have, you know, ways of measuring progress. And the minute you do that, the journey of the individual is out, generally. And, you know, the individual becomes subservient to the goals of the institution. We saw it in the West, and we see it in Buddhism also. Same exact process, no difference. So for many of us, that's not going to work. You know, we simply can't take on the Asian organized religion as an alternative to Western organized religion because it doesn't produce the results. The other alternative, and by the way, in our community, we have that tendency, you know, all of us have the tendency to want to pull it together and pin it down and have some kind of security that I know what this lineage is, I know what the rules are, and I know, you know, once you know the rules, you can get in control of the situation because you just follow rules. And I want things to be more tidy, more coherent. You know, I don't want a new phase every year or two in this sangha. I want the teachings to be laid out there, put them in a book, and I'll just do it. So we have that tendency in ourselves. We would like that. The other extreme that we have in our culture is, well, I'm just going to do it myself. I'm just going to make my own journey. I'm going to, you know, this week it's jogging. You know, and maybe later it'll be shamanism. You know, I'll look into that. And then after that, I'll look into Orthodox Christianity. And then maybe at a certain point along the way, I'll do some, you know, mescaline, or we'll do some peyote, or... And I'll just kind of put it together myself and fashion it. I don't know how it goes, but anyway, the basic idea is that you can't be your own physician. Even if you're a good physician, you can't be your own physician because you can't see. You're blinded by your own agendas and your own needs, your own wants. And I think it's definitely true of spirituality. The problem with running your own journey is that you make decisions that are not based on actually what's the big picture. You make decisions based on the smaller picture. And of course, we see it in the culture at large. You know, there's so many people interested in spirituality, but they're simply unwilling to enter into otherness, you know, the otherness of a sangha or the otherness of a teacher, and they want to be in control. And I think it's, Trungpa Rinpoche talked about it all the time, but, you know, obviously we have to check out what he says against experience, but in my experience, it doesn't really work either. So we have these two interesting things. Organized religion doesn't work. And I think, you know, simply trying to do one's own thing doesn't really work either, at least as far as spirituality goes. As Rinpoche used to say, the ego can't give up the ego. You can't witness your own death. You can't have a witness witnessing. The witness is the ego, the watcher. And you can't have a witness witnessing the dissolution of the ego. And when we engage in managing our own spiritual journey and, you know, putting one, cobbling one thing together after another, depending on how we're feeling, there's always a witness and there's always a watcher, because the watcher is the one who's in control. It doesn't work. You know, where, as I was saying last night, where does that really leave us? And I think where it leaves us is back to the Buddha's original teaching before Buddhism began to become a lot more complicated, and back to Trungpa Rinpoche's teaching, interestingly enough, before it became more complicated, which is that meditation is the beginning and the middle and the end of Buddhism, and end of the Dharma, beginning, middle, and the end of the Dharma. And if we practice, something happens, and if we don't practice, not that much happens.
To download more of Reggie's teachings, find out about upcoming retreats, and to explore a variety of audio listening guides to assist you on your spiritual journey, please visit dharmaocean.org. Music is by Jeff Beal and Nawang Ketchog from the album Tibet, Cry of the Snow Lion.